Good day, and welcome to Holden Village. Today's date is September 12th, 2002. This session is Living and Giving, a look at 2 Corinthians. Stewardship, chapters 8 and 9. You can find this also in our book library, or our tape library, or through the bookstore, under the headings W.E.K. 2002-4. Why don't we listen in?
And let's just begin with a word of prayer. Our Lord Jesus, once again we begin this day with thoughts of you. We thank you for the beauty of this place and for our opportunity to look into your word to find some insights and some ideas and some new concepts that will help us understand you and grow in our faith with you. Help us in our discussion today and in our conversation to learn more, to grow more in our faith, and to listen to one another. In the name of Jesus we pray. Amen. Some of the things I think small enough now where we've got, at least we can know people's first names. It might be kind of helpful. I know some of you, I don't know all of you, but my name, first name is Knight. This is
Dawn.
Bob.
Liz.
Liz.
Trisha.
Trisha.
Clary.
Clary.
Susan.
And Susan. Well, before I make some comments about 8 and 9, do you have any questions about the first 7 chapters, I guess, we've discussed? Anything that you've pondered a little bit or thought about over the last day or so that was sort of intriguing to you, or anything that puzzled you about what we talked about?
Paul had adversaries. But they don't have a name. Who were they?
Well, for example, the individual that we talked about yesterday, we don't know who that was. He doesn't mention them by name, and I'm not sure why that is, except they come under that general category of Judaizers, which were people that tended to be very strict interpreters of the Jewish law. And when that got translated to the Christian faith, it was sort of like what they called the Jerusalem Party. And this will kind of get us into today's conversation, because the Jerusalem Party were the Jewish Christians led by Peter, who was the main spokesperson, and they just had a very strict understanding of who could possibly be a part of Christ's kingdom. And Jewishness was first, and then Christianity followed their Jewishness. Well, Paul's whole ministry, of course, was a ministry to the Gentiles and the non-Jews. And so his approach was so different. I mean, he looked to all these different countries and different city-states and different locales and would begin churches there, many times within the Jewish communities where he'd start. But nevertheless, he would very quickly move out into the cities and outlying areas and begin to attract people that would come listen to him talk. And this disturbed the Judaizers, because they felt that Paul was contaminating the faith, that he was sort of undermining the effects of what they saw to be the true and clear faith. And the interesting thing about today's lesson, of course, when we talk about this collection for the church in Jerusalem, it's an interesting kind of little double play, because Paul is actually trying to raise money for these people that don't like it very well, because they're in trouble. The Jerusalem church has had some major financial issues, and this is sort of speculative too, but if you remember the book of Acts, they talk about the early Christian community. I think it's in Acts chapter 6 or 7, where they had everything in common. You know, they shared everything. It was kind of like your first version of communism. Well, the idea there was that over time, the Jerusalem community got very in deep financial trouble. They didn't have enough. They were sharing everything, but no one was really accounting for anything. And so the church in Jerusalem, which was the mother church, was in trouble. So then the other Christians in the outlying communities were asked to help support and maintain so that the main church would not fall flat on its face. And Paul is out raising money at these churches at Thessalonica and Ephesus and Corinth and so forth, and trying to raise money to send back, and he was going to bring it back to Jerusalem. But the interesting thing was, in many times, the mother church in Jerusalem was very skeptical about these, because even though some of these churches, like in Corinth, certainly had the Jewish element, they also had these non-Jews that were part of the congregation too. And that was sort of the interesting play there. So here he is in chapter 9, trying to raise money for his so-called enemies, if you will. I mean, well, that's probably putting it pretty bluntly, but they certainly were not in any way necessarily supportive of what some of the things he was doing in ministry. So, you want to send back some questions? Well, let's just look at chapters 8 and 9, and if we want to look at some of the questions, maybe it would be kind of helpful if we just kind of go through some of these questions. That would kind of help us get on task a little bit in terms of what the main emphasis that Paul's trying to put. I would say that, I made this comment earlier, that chapters 8 and 9 are probably two of the most oft-quoted chapters, at least in the New Testament, when it comes to stewardship principles and why it is that that people support their church, and you know, what are the attitudes and perspectives that Christians ought to have relative to their giving and that whole kind of concept. So let's just start reading chapter 8, and if someone would like to start, that would be okay, and then I'll kind of stop and make some comments, and we can look at some of these questions. For those of you who just came in, we're kind of looking at questions both for Wednesday and Thursday, because we're talking about 8 and 9 today.
We want you to know, brothers and sisters, about the grace of God that has been granted to the churches of Macedonia. For during a severe ordeal of affliction, their abundant joy and their extreme poverty have overflowed in a wealth of generosity on their part. For, as I can testify, they voluntarily gave according to their means, and even beyond their means, begging us earnestly for the privilege of sharing in this ministry to the saints. And this, not merely as we expected, they gave themselves first to the Lord, and by the will of God, to us, so that we might urge Titus that as he had already made the beginning, so he should also complete this generous undertaking among you. Now as you excel in everything, in faith, in speech, in knowledge, in utmost eagerness, and in our love for you, so we want you to excel also in this generous undertaking.
Okay, that's good. So what is Paul sort of saying to the church now here? What's he trying to, I guess, glean from them, you might say?
Well, basically thanking them for their generosity.
He begins by saying thanks, exactly. And what else does he say?
That they gave beyond their means.
Right. Now, which church is he talking about here? The church at Corinth or the churches in Macedonia?
Macedonia.
Okay. And what are we sort of picking up about the nature of this, of these churches in Macedonia? And this would be in Thessalonica and some of these places up there in northern Greece. What's sort of the situation up there?
They're poor.
They're very poor. They got no money. Few resources. But in spite of that, what are they? They are generous. Now, I don't know what your experience is of giving and those kind of things within congregations, but you know, it does seem to be the trend that the poorer congregations often seem to be the more generous congregations in terms of their giving. Not necessarily on the basis of the amount, but on the basis of the proportion of what they give. And the interesting thing, I did some work in stewardship when I worked for the Synod years ago. The interesting thing about that is that holds true with individuals too. If you look at the statistics, as income rises for individuals, the percentage that they give to charitable contributions or to the churches decreases. Now you think, well, if they had more money, they would give more. Actually, just the opposite is true. The more that we tend to have, the less proportion we give away, we keep for ourselves. And that's certainly true of congregations as well. So it's congregational as well as individual. I remember a statistic that said that if every Christian would suddenly go on welfare, that they would have to go on welfare, and that they would give 10% of that amount to the church, that the income of congregations would triple. You know, this is like phenomenal kind of statistics like that. So, you know, the bottom line is, in terms of what we think about it, in terms of financial stewardship, you know, we've got a long ways to go. And this understanding of giving and why we give are just things that I think there's a lot of growth that Christians, all of us, can learn from. And so this is one of the reasons, I think, why this particular passage becomes so instructive for us in terms of particularly our financial stewardship. But the one verse I wanted to point out to you, which I think is very interesting here, is verse 7 that Bob read. It said, he literally says, now, you excel in everything. You know, you are faithful in utterance, in knowledge, in eagerness, in earnestness, in your love. So if you do all these things, then hopefully you will excel in your financial stewardship as well. I mean, it should be a natural kind of an outgrowth. If you do all these Christian, Christ-like things before, doesn't it make sense that you would also be a generous giver? Okay, let's look at, continue on reading here at verse 8. Anybody want to just pick it up there?
I do not say that this is a command, but I am testing the genuineness of your love against the earnestness of others. For you know the generous acts of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for your sake he became poor, so that by his poverty you might become rich. And in this matter I am giving my advice. It is appropriate for you who began last year not only to do something, but even to desire to do something. Now finish doing it, so that your eagerness may be matched by completing it according to your means. For if the eagerness is there, the gift is acceptable according to what one has, not according to what one does not have. I do not mean that there should be relief for others and pressure on you, but it is a question of a fair balance between your present abundance and their need, so that their abundance may be for your need, in order that there may be a fair balance. As it is written, the one who had much did not have too much. The one who had little did not have too little.
Okay, if you look at the questions here, let's look at question number 2 under Wednesday, which refers to verse 5. And what is the first principle in Christian stewardship according to what we have there? Look at verse 5.
According to your needs.
give according to what you have. All right. And that's also repeated then in verse 12, is it not? Mm-hmm. It says, for if the readiness is there, it is acceptable according to what a person has, not according to what he doesn't have. So that's the first principle in Christian giving, is that you look at what God has given you, and then you respond accordingly. What other insights do you see in that little section that Don read from verses 8 through? Anything else that gives us some insights about attitudes or perspectives or anything of the sort there?
Giving to God first.
Giving to God first. So in terms of priorities, it's like saying that ought to be the first. Now I know probably all of us have heard sermons about that or have done Bible studies or read those kinds of things, but you know, it is such a it's such a basic truth. I mean, in our particular situation, when Susan and I got married 32 years ago, we determined that we were going to be tithers. Just that's just the way we're going to do it, and we've done that for all these years. You know, we've always said the first check that's written always goes to the church, and it's always that proportion. And the interesting thing about that is, over the years, is that we have obviously our income has significantly increased when we first started. When I first started in ministry, my first call in the little town of Valley, Nebraska, we earned $6,000 a year. So, you know, I'm earning probably about 10 times that amount now. But the tithe, $6,000 at 10%, was $600. You know, a tithe of $60,000 obviously is quite a bit more than that. But the idea there is the proportion is the same. And in our tradition, and I think part of the some of the Old Testament analogies that we many of us have used over the back is that that tithe, that 10%, has been sort of a kind of a benchmark for Christians over the years of saying, you know, that's sort of like a basic concept in terms of what is a worthy proportion to return to the Lord in terms of what God has done for us. And this idea that you give to God first in terms of priorities does make a huge, huge impact in terms of how you see the rest of your life. Because if God's a priority, then everything else becomes a secondary issue. And that affects not only the stewardship part, but it affects everything we do. Anything else you see in those 8 verses?
According to my translation, it talks about giving with eagerness.
Eagerness,
which
sure.
Which I really like.
Right. So it's not like a duty. It's a sense of eagerness. And you know, I have to say that this has been sort of my impression over the years too, is once a person gets into this mentality of giving, they don't, I mean, like one guy said, I have never met a former tither. Mm-hmm. You know, because once you do it and you experience the joy and the refreshment and the sense of giving that it's part of that, it's you don't want to go back to any other way. You know, it's just a very, very fulfilling kind of experience. And you do have that sense of eagerness and sense of positive relationship with the Lord that just makes things seem to fit.
I have a question.
Yeah.
About tithing.
Yeah.
You talk about giving it to the church. Mm-hmm. Can you count in your mind giving it to charities?
Oh, sure.
Because yeah. There's times a church may be doing things that you don't necessarily want to contribute a whole lot of money to, like maybe building something really pretty and not doing the outreach.
Right. Yeah, I think a lot of people have different ways of working that through in their own situation, but And there was, I mean, like in our case, for example, we, and this is just us personally, this is not anything else, just the way we have a 10% thing for the church, but then we will also contribute to a lot of other causes, like, you know, the cancer fund, or we have a Lutheran Social Services in our state that's very, very active, and we give to the seminary, and we, you know, there's a lot of other things too. It's just that the tithe kind of thing is sort of a, it's sort of a base. It doesn't mean you can't give more than that or anything of the sort, but it just kind of gives us a benchmark, and it kind of reminds us of the proportion, you know, what we ought to be looking at in terms of, you know, what is right. Because a lot of people say, well, how much should I give? Well, that's your own personal decision how much you should give. But at least the scriptures offer at least some suggestions in terms of guidelines.
It's interesting that, you know, longitudinal perspective. In the Lutheran church, we did not talk a lot about tithing, especially in Texas where you have a lot of Baptists where it's sort of mandatory kind of thing. So you wanted to be a little different. And I've recently been involved in our Synod stewardship thing through deployed staff, mm-hmm. church-wide, where clearly the emphasis is on moving towards the tithe or moving beyond the tithe. So we're really talking it officially from church-wide.
Right, and that's true. I mean, it started years ago, but mm-hmm. there are some denominational groups that are much more articulate and much more forceful about that. For example, people in the Seventh-day Adventist tradition and even the Mormon tradition are very, very strict about that. People in the in some of the more evangelical churches are. But I think the last statistics I saw, at least within the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, and I think some of the Missouri Synod, I think the average, if we took, is somewhere between 2.5 to possibly 3% at the top.
But that is what those two, let's say ELCA, and some of us being involved with church colleges,
right,
or seminaries or something, I mean, that never gets into the statistics.
That's correct.
There are a lot of big donors that are very important to these institutions.
That's correct. And that's what, to your point, a lot of times people will give in other ways besides just to their congregation or to their denomination.
And so this they is what give. That registers.
Correct.
It doesn't have the whole picture.
Correct, correct. And we do that even within our own congregation. I mean, we try to, and some churches give as high as 20 or 30% of their congregational income to missions and so forth. And, you know, there's no hard and fast rule to that either. But, you know, I guess the whole point about this is that when you're thinking about how much, then you begin to think about, well, is there some kind of guideline? Is there some kind of basis for which we can make a decision about our own personal stewardship as well as the stewardship of our church?
And may I say one more thing? Yeah. I think for a congregation, I think there's statistics that show that too. The congregation that does not tithe beyond itself is probably not very active. And I know for years I've had a sort of a fight when budget time came around to make sure that we were giving at least 10% to benevolences.
Right.
We finally got there, but to maintain it.
Right.
And that's a sign of congregational health.
It is true.
Yeah.
It is true. And I think this is what these two chapters kind of show us as we promote giving. It's a contagious kind of a thing. People tend to, you know, giving begets giving. There's that old, you know, talk about some of the churches, well, we can't afford to give that much away because we've got to take care of our own ministries. Well, that's a sort of a self-defeating attitude, because if you can get people in the spirit of giving, it's just, we'll see this in one of the verses later, that it multiplies itself. And the whole purpose of giving is to really create an attitude or perspective. And once you've got that perspective, then you don't go back. You don't go back to holding.
For years, I would not. I think that happens with individuals, too, because I remember we were at that place. We had six children. They were all headed for college. We did that same thing. We can't afford.
Right.
But the year that we had four kids at our college, we decided to try it.
Yeah.
And it's amazing. They all got educated.
I know.
And we did just fine. And I think congregations do that same thing. They say, well, we can't afford.
Right.
And they can afford to just as well as we could have afforded.
Sure. That's very true.
The verse that I really love here is begging us earnestly for the privilege of sharing in this ministry.
Mm-hmm.
And if we all had that attitude, we wouldn't have stewardship problems.
That's true. That's true. And see, I've always maintained, too, that congregations, if the people capture that sense of giving, no congregation should ever have a giving problem, I mean, or a stewardship problem. Because if it's there, it's a contagious thing. And I don't know what some of your experiences are in churches, but, you know, you can tell by looking at bulletins and reading newsletters whether those things are going on. And you can also tell if they're not going on. And we've served both kinds of congregations in our ministries, and it's a pretty obvious. And you're very correct when you say that it's a mission sense that when you start thinking about others' needs and other people's needs before your own, when you start thinking about, you know, God first and ourselves second, it does change the way you see life. It's just a different way of looking at life. Well, let's pick up here with verse 16, because this is still more of the same here. Someone want to start reading verse 16 to the end there?
How we thank God for making Titus as eager as we are to help you. Now, this is today's English version.
That's fine. So
it's
fine.
Going to be a lot different.
That's fine.
What y'all have. Okay. Not only did he welcome our request, he was so eager to help that of his own free will, he decided to go to you. With him, we are sending the brother who is highly respected in all the churches for his work in preaching the gospel. And besides that, he has been chosen and appointed by the churches to travel with us as we carry out this service of love for the sake of the Lord's glory and in order to show that we want to help. We are being careful not to stir up any complaints about the way we handle this generous gift. Our purpose is to do what is right, not only in the sight of the Lord, but also in the sight of man. So we are sending our brother with them. We have tested him many times and found him always very eager to help. And now that he has so much confidence in you, he is all the more eager to help. As for Titus, he is my partner and works with me to help you. As for the other brothers who are going with him, they represent the churches and bring glory to Christ. Show your love to them so that all the churches will be sure of it and know that we are right in boasting about you.
So what do you think is Paul's psychological motive here in talking to the church? What's he trying to promote in terms of their attitude?
Responsibility,
mm-hmm.
in terms of trustworthiness and management of,
right.
the funds.
And isn't that, that's another aspect of the giving that is so critical. Because people, when they lose that sense of trusting the organization or whatever, you know, it affects their attitude. And so Paul is making sure that he's giving justification, I guess, if you will, and assurance that this money that they're giving is going to go where they said it's going to go. Okay? It's not going to be lost in his pocket or something else. Well, you think about some of these groups, you know, look, if you know anything about the United Way several years ago, they had a major scandal in their hierarchy. Well, that affected the way people look at the United Way. And if there's a sense that a church or an organization is not fiscally responsible, you know, that makes them suspect, and people are not as apt to want to support them. They say, well, what's going on?
It makes all charities call under that veil, too.
It does. It does. It affects, you're right, it affects everything. And and that's one of the aspects of why it's so important for, you know, churches or whatever to be able to have this concept of open books or good fiscal management, because, you know, if the average parishioner wants to go to the congregation and say, well, pastor, what's going on here with how are you spend this money? Well, you know, you hopefully you'd be able to show them, and we do that extensively, our congregation. If there's any questions, we always say, you know, you can come in and check us out anytime you want to. And if you don't do that, you know, sometimes you pay the price in terms of response by people.
My mundane old mind wondered how in the world they moved the money around in those days.
by sacks.
Yeah. But I mean, you think you travel out across country for days at a time,
right?
Lugging money bags, it just seems
well, and even, you know, and
dangerous, certainly.
Dangerous, and certainly you could be robbed or whatever, you know. So,
Patricia is the one who should say this, but I mean, in terms of the statistics, like for Lutheran World Relief, I mean, recognized nationwide in terms of percentage of what is given going there. I mean, it's a top statistic. You may have some of those in your mind.
Well, there's only about 5% that goes to administration in most cases.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. And that's a very low percent. Yeah, or World Hunger or something like that.
Look at question number 5 under Wednesday. Again, going back to what we just read here earlier, you might call this the second stewardship principle, but what is Paul alluding to in verses 11 through 15, would you say? The first principle we've already identified as being as giving according to what you have, not according to what you don't have. But what's the second one, would you say?
Part of it is completing it, follow through.
Right. Now, I don't know what your congregations do in terms of pledging and that kind of a thing, but one of the aspects of this whole idea of making a commitment or making a pledge to give a certain amount over a course of a year is it's kind of a reminder for us to complete what we said we were going to do. And I think that's always an issue that we need to be aware of in our own giving, is that you know, sometimes you come into a situation and there are temptations along the way not to do well. You know, it's that old story of God's Little Acre. Remember that one by the Southern writer Erskine Caldwell? It was his land, but he was going to give that 1 acre to God, and then they found something valuable on it, so then he moved another acre, and that was God's acre, and then, you know, the thing kept moving around until he had the lesser of the value of the one. But that is another stewardship principle that Paul is talking about here. Anybody see any other ones?
I still remember talking about pledging when we lived in Wyoming. Had a family come to the church where we were, and they had belonged to another congregation in town. And he was a farmer or rancher, one of the two, and had a bum year. And he'd gone into the pastor and said, we're just not going to be able to make our pledge. We've had a bad year, and the money just simply isn't there. And the response was, well, you'll probably enjoy the facilities and things as much as the rest of the people who did make their commitments. They were gone. Mm-hmm. I thought, what an absolutely gross thing to say to somebody who was having financial
trouble. I didn't hear that, Don. What?
They said, well, you'll probably continue to enjoy the facilities and the amenities of the church as much as the people who did make their pledge and make their commitment. Ooh, is right.
Well, and I think that a lot of times too, and I've heard some of these horror stories too about what people and pastors have said to individuals relative to their financial situation, and it is very distressing. But you know, if you think about the first principle of giving according to what you have, not according to what you don't have, then it makes sense. I mean, if you have a terrible year and you have no money, then you know, obviously you aren't going to be able to give anything. On the other hand, if you have a very good year and God blesses you, then you do respond. You know, it's that little story, I think it was a cartoon I saw a long time ago. This guy standing in an unemployment line, he says, it's a lot easier to tithe than I don't have a job, you know. It's that, you know. But again, it's based on that principle that you give according to what you have, not according to what you don't have. I mean, that's where it all starts. And so, and that's why I think some congregations have gotten themselves into trouble when they have sort of expected, let's say, that, you know, everybody ought to have X amount of dollars, you know. We have a budget of $300,000. Every member ought to give, you know, 300 members divided by 300,000. Well, that doesn't work that way. And, you know, that's part of the whole living in community thing, is when some people are really in trouble financially, then the church ought to be there to sort of help them out, not to expect that they're going to
jump on them,
pay their way, or jump on them for not being able to complete their commitment. And then again, going back to the original idea of the church and churches of Macedonia, you know, they are the poorest of all the churches, and yet they are still somehow able to find ways in which they can help others. Okay, let's give, let's look at question 6 and 7 under one, and I thought they were kind of, at least helpful to kind of put a personal touch. When in your own experience, what holds the most concern for you about stewardship and giving money for the ministry of the church? And kind of a secondary question, that what motivates you? You know, if you think about giving to support the church, what are the motivators that really work for you and encourage you in your own situation?
Well, I'll go to 7 first. We had a long period in our congregation, happened to be a covenant church. Those of you who don't know the covenant church, it broke off in the Lutherans about 1885 in Sweden. We've been better off ever since. I'm sorry. Actually, what motivated our congregation, it seems that there was never mention of money.
Mm.
It was understood that if your heart and soul were in the right place, that the money would come.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was never a sermon about money.
Mm.
There was never a stewardship drop. I don't know, we moved a little bit away from that. We're a little bit more organized. I think some people with more of accounting procedures, and we also got into a building project, so that's been going on a little bit more, organizing that piece. But for, there was a decade there when we first joined our church where there was never mention of money.
And that was really helpful for you in terms of your perspective. That we just took the emphasis away from that.
Yep.
But there was no budget, nothing like this?
There definitely was a budget, but it was in the bulletin, it would say giving up to this point, budget per year, that's all that was ever done. But no pledge drive, nothing. And I found that refreshing, because the emphasis is what you should be doing as Christians, mm-hmm. and obviously that does take money, and it worked. In fact,
as I was going to say, it worked very well. It was effective for that church, mm-hmm. and probably still is, I'm assuming.
Well, like I said, I started to say we do more organizationally in terms of keeping our people aware of what the financial situation is.
Mm-hmm.
And I think our current pastor has had a sermon on stewardship. Of course, stewardship involves a broader area.
Right. It's not just financial stewardship.
But, so that's what motivates me, is not to be hounded about money.
Mm-hmm.
I belong to a similar congregation that never talked about money when it came to budget for ourselves, but talked about ministry outreach to others,
mm-hmm.
what was going to be given outside of the congregation.
Mm-hmm.
Talked about that. And it was different for me to belong to that kind of congregation. And when they started a building campaign and talked about the fact that they were building that $3 million plus sanctuary and never had a capital campaign, I felt just a little nervous about that, how that was going to happen. And I went to the pastor and asked, weren't you going to have
He said, no, everybody knows. We talk always about others. We don't need to talk about ourselves. Mm. And they built that $3 million facility without any kind of Catholic community. Mm. To me, that is quite astounding. But as I looked at it, it told me that when you give outside of yourselves, sure, the inside will take care of itself.
Right.
And that was really revealing for my own stewardship.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I think going to that question 7 for me, I think all of my feeling on stewardship is just wrapped up in my own email address, blessed to give.
Mm-hmm.
That just says it all to me, that I've been given abundance.
Sure.
And that's what it's about, is to give it away. It's not about inside.
Right.
It's not about my own needs. And it came from being at that congregation.
Mm-hmm. That's beautiful. Any other experiences that you've had about that in your life?
I just want to say, in terms of motivation, the more, well, I've been blessed with so many church-wide involvement things, and I've seen what happens, you know, with the money that is sent there. And so that motivates one to do more, like having been involved with a church college for 40 years, I know the needs and all of that. So from the inside, seeing more of the inside, that's motivating.
Right.
I mean, you're committed to the cause.
Right. And I think that is so true of so much of what we do. If our lives are very much active in our congregations and in our organizations and stuff like that, you see where the money goes, you see how it's used. You don't really need a lot more than that in terms of your response. It's just a natural kind of a thing. You want to support something that's good. Well, let's quickly go into chapter 9 here, and someone would read the first 5 verses there. We'll start with that. This is still more of the same for Paul, but let's kind of plow through here.
Now it is not necessary for me to write to you about the ministry of the saints, for I know your eagerness, which is the subject of my boasting about you to the people of Macedonia, saying that, no, I don't have to say that word, Archaea, has already been ready since last year, and your zeal has stirred up most of them. But I am sending the brothers in order that our boasting about you may not prove to have been empty in this case, so that you may be ready, as I said you would be. Otherwise, if some Macedonians come with me and find that you are not ready, we would be humiliated, to say nothing of you, in this undertaking. So I thought it necessary to urge the brothers to go on ahead of you and arrange in advance for this bountiful gift that you have promised, so that it may be ready as a voluntary gift and not as an exhortation.
Okay. Now see, there's another principle here going on. And what would that be?
Preparation,
but in terms of the actual gift.
Competition.
Well, there's motivation going on there by Paul, isn't there? I mean, he's putting it on pretty thick. You know, I don't want to be embarrassed with you people. I talked about you, and you guys are great givers, and you know, and I want to set this guy ahead of the time, and I want to make sure you do what I know you're going to do. But the very last verse that was read there, verse 5, what does it say?
It was a voluntary gift.
Okay, it's a voluntary gift. And see, that's where I think so much of the giving problems come in, is when you have situations where someone else is telling another person what they ought to do. I mean, that's where, you know, we raise the ire, we get people upset, people react negatively to that, because in one sense, that was kind of what your point was. I mean, you don't know what I went through this last year. You have no idea what my situation was, and yet you make a comment like, you know, I should be doing more. And so this thing about a voluntary contribution is so critical to good, because you have to feel right about that within yourself. And there's nobody in the world that can tell you, you know, what you ought to do. Well, I can tell you what you ought to do, but it's not up to them, it's up to you. And then look at verse 6, let's go down through verse 11 here. Someone read those verses.
But this I say, he which soweth sparingly shall reap also sparingly, and he which soweth bountifully shall reap also bountifully. Every man according as he purposeth in his heart, so let him give, not grudgingly or of necessity, for God loveth a cheerful giver. And God is able to make all grace abound toward you, that he, always having all sufficiency in all things, may abound to you to every good work. As it is written, he hath dispersed abroad, he hath given to the poor, his righteousness remaineth forever. Now he that ministereth seed to the sower, both minister bread for your food, and multiply your seed sown, and increase the fruits of your righteousness.
That's great. So what do you think is the meaning of that sowing sparingly, reaping sparingly, sowing bountifully, reaping bountifully? Have you had any experiences with that?
The more you give, the better you feel.
Yeah. I think that's certainly some of it. See, I kind of come to the over the years of saying that basically all of us if we catch that giving spirit, we do have a sense that that we are responding to God's call to us. I mean, that a generous spirit is so much a part of the Christian lifestyle that I don't know any other way to say it. And again, it's not just a matter of money. It's a matter of just the way you live your life. You have these priorities, and you have these concerns for others, and you have a certain perspective on the way that what God has done for you. And when that's carried through, it is the essence of a Christian lifestyle. It's just it's a generous spirit. And if you don't have that generous spirit or don't see that generous spirit, then you begin to question a little bit about, you know, what's going on in terms of your faith journey and that type of a thing. You know, and it does seem in so many ways that the more you give, you know, somehow the more there is. It's a hard thing to explain. I mean, I can't really quantify that other than to say that that's certainly been our experience. I mean, the more we give, it seems like the more we have. And in terms of financial stuff, I'm talking more in terms of blessings and sense of connectedness with family and with friends and with congregations and with, you know, the whole thing. You were going to say.
There is a marvelous little children's book by Augsburg, which I've used in a sermon illustration on stewardship, which I would recommend to anyone. It's called Cheer Up Chicken. And it really teaches the idea, not in a moralistic way, but with humor, that to give brings back blessing to you. The blessed. And so check out Augsburg, Cheer Up Chicken.
Cheer Up Chicken.
Cheer Up Chicken. I won't take time to tell the story, but it's well illustrated. Probably an old story, but it's retold in new format. And Augsburg has been selling them like hotcakes.
Okay.
Thank you.
That's good.
Each one is different.
Look at the stewardship principle in verses 8 and 9. What do you think that one has to do? Verses 8 and 9. We talked about giving according to what you have, not according to what you don't have. And then we talked about making it a voluntary choice, not one that's an exaction or an expectation by somebody else. What would be the third principle here in verses 8 and 9?
Well, he's surely implying that God has given
people are in abundance.
Right.
And they should share that abundance.
Right. It'll be more than enough.
It'll be more than enough, you know. It's like that story of the prophet Elijah when he was had the grain and he kept every morning woke up and there was grain in there. Yeah. One of the great stories that I've told at a few weddings is this, and it's a story. It's not a biblical story, but it's about these two brothers. One was single and the other one was married. And they were concerned about each other because the single brother said, well, you know, my married brother has so many mouths to feed and I'm worried about him. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to take some of my grain and I'm going to sneak it over to his home in the evening when he doesn't know so he'll have enough for his family. And the married brother was thinking about his single brother. He says, you know, I have so many blessings. I have a family, and he has nobody except me. And when he dies, he won't have anybody to take care of him. I might not take care of him before he dies. When he gets older, he won't have anybody to take care of him. And so what I'll do is provide for his needs. I'll sneak some food over to his home while he's not looking and so forth. And then the end of the little story is that the two brothers met each other in the barn and they were filling each other's bins up, and then that was the beauty of the moment, and they embraced and they saw how much they cared for one another. But it's that whole idea about, you know, again, this giving spirit that just sort of translates into whatever you do, be it your immediate family members or people that you don't even know as well. And that God does provide you with these blessings that that go beyond any of our expectations. Look at verses 14 and 15, and we'll finish up this chapter here real quickly. But on verses 14, the role of prayer in stewardship, and question number 7, why is it important that our giving to the church be free and not reluctant in any way? And let me just finish out that you guys can follow along. I'm reading from the RSV version here. He who supplies seed to the sower and bread for food will supply and multiply your resources and increase the harvest of your righteousness. You'll be enriched in every way for great generosity, which through us will produce thanksgiving to God. For the rendering of this service not only supplies the wants of the saints, but also overflows in many thanksgivings to God. Under the test of this service, you will glorify God by your obedience in acknowledging the gospel of Christ, and by the generosity of your contribution for them and for all others. While they long for you and pray for you, because of the surpassing grace of God in you, thanks be to God for his inexpressible gift. So, in that little section, what would you say is the role of prayer in terms of our stewardship and giving and that type of thing?
It's an integral part.
Mm-hmm. And so often, I think in our prayer life, when we're attentive to not only our own needs and our own concerns, but the concerns of others, it does oftentimes translate there into actually some kind of action in which we find ways in which we can assist others and meet their needs and respond to their concerns, be it through financial gifts or through just gifts from which we're able to just share some of our time and our talents and so forth with them.
It also sounds somewhat like he's saying that their giving has answered the prayers of others.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. it's been God's answer to their prayer. Right, right. Well, and I think I've got to find the verse here because I think there's one is I can't remember if it's in chapter 8 or chapter 9, but the whole key to this whole thing is way before we talk about the financial part of this thing, Paul says the first thing was that they gave themselves to the Lord. I guess it's in chapter 8, verse 5. First, they gave themselves to the Lord and to us by the will of God. In other words, that all this stuff is dependent upon the basic relationship a person has with God. I mean, if you give yourself to God initially, then everything else begins to follow that trend. You know, the way you live your life, the way you look at other people, the way you look at your community, the way you look at your church. You know, it's all based on that fundamental, and that goes back to the priority kind of a thing. You know, what are your priorities and what, you know, what comes first in your life? And if you first give yourself to the Lord, then all these other things follow on.
This idea, though, of letting people know you're praying for them. Sometimes you cannot help their situation financially or something like that. But if someone knows they're being prayed for, that affirms them and sometimes helps them to do more for themselves because they know someone cares for them.
Very true.
So that praying for others is a real gift.
It is.
And I personally have been blessed by that, by knowing that someone said, I'm praying for you. And, mm-hmm. You know.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of us have had those experiences. I mean, I certainly have had too. I mean, one of the things that our church did, I've never had a church do this until about 2 years ago. I didn't even know there was such a week, but there was a week called Pastor's Appreciation Week. Maybe you guys do this all the time for your pastor, but I never had this experience until a couple of years ago. And I think I had I bet you I had like 75 cards or 100 cards from people that just said, you know, we're praying for you this week and we're thinking about you and thank you for this and da-da-da-da-da. You know, it was just overwhelming to me. And the other pastors on our staff had the same thing happen to them. And it was, you're right, it was just like, just unbelievable. And it does make such an impact, I think, for people to know that you're praying for them. And it's certainly true when we face things like illness and death. You know, if someone drops a note in the mail and says, you know, you've been in my prayers this last week or something like that.
And people in nursing homes who say, I can't do anything anymore. But you can pray.
Sure.
I mean, that
That's
is a
true.
Gift.
That's true.
Yeah.
Very true. Well, we're probably about done for today, but any other closing comments or thoughts, or appreciate your insights very much in this today. This is
an
interesting conversation and lots to think about.
Thank you.
So next week, I keep talking about
yes.
Tomorrow, we'll hit this last section of the book. And keep in mind now that chapters 10 through 13 and the section from chapter 6, verse 14 through 7, 1 could be the unknown or the painful letter, okay, of Paul. Because if you start with chapter 10 and you just finished reading chapter 9, there's a marked change in Paul's attitude and perspective in chapter 10. And that's what makes a lot of the scholars think that this is a different letter or came at a different time. So as you read through those last three or four chapters, kind of keep that in mind as a potential framework in which to place this section. Thanks very much.